Since then, Wilson had become perhaps Egypt's most valuable congressional champion. Dennis Neal had skillfully lobbied his old friend, but as always, it was the personal connection that energized the congressman. "I liked Egypt. I liked Sadat. And I love Muhammad," he explains. "Helping my friends? What the fuck?" With Trish exiled to the bedroom, Charlie had fleshed in all of this history, culminating with the unusual commitment that his friend the defense minister had made. The field marshal was prepared to waive all rules and regulations in selling Egyptian equipment to the CIA. No paperwork would be necessary, no governmental approvals. Not even President Mubarak need be consulted. It could all be done with a handshake because of Abu Razala's confidence in Wilson. Abu Razala arranged for a demonstration the following morning of the weapon he insisted would be perfect for the Afghans, the Mule Portable ZSU-23. The field marshal didn't attend, it was below his dignity. He left the field work to his generals, who were all waiting anxiously as the Americans gathered in the desert. Gust noted with dismay that Dennis Neal was once again with Charlie, all dressed up in his Alan Ladd desert suit. Avrakatos was still offended at the idea of a lobbyist for the Egyptian defense minister glomming on to a CIA mission, so he perversely enjoyed watching Dennis sweating his balls off in his suit. A surreal sight awaited the odd delegation of Americans as they drove through the desert to the spot the Egyptians had chosen for the demonstration. Abu Razala's generals had not only brought the ZSU-23s into the desert, but also a collection of round white tables with umbrellas and red and white checked tablecloths so that the honored guests could sit in comfort. Each table sported a lunchbox filled with Kentucky Fried Chicken. The conditions couldn't have been less pleasant, however. Wanting to simulate the mountainous terrain of Afghanistan, the Egyptians had chosen the sloping incline of a landfill over a sprawling desert garbage dump. Furthermore, no parasol could tame the desert heat that day. It was at least 110 degrees in the shade, everyone was soaking, and the hot wind made Avrakatos feel like he was in a sauna with a fan running. There were pitchers of Pepsi-Cola, which the Americans drank incessantly, but no one could think much about eating the fried chicken. Then things began to take on a comedic dimension, so much so that it was hard for Alper, Pratt, and Vickers not to smirk at one another. The Egyptian gunners were standing at attention as a three-star general who talked as if he had been educated at Oxford gave a rousing description of the ZSU-23's attributes. The key point he made, at the urging of his advisors, Gust had insisted on this demonstration, was that after his men fired at a target across the desert, the Americans would see how easily the gun could be broken down and moved by mule up the incline. Even the doubting weapons experts were suitably impressed with the first part of the exercise. They could see through their binoculars how smoothly and accurately the guns fired. The Egyptians then began to strip the gun down to move it up the hill. The object, after all, was to have a gun that the Mujahideen could actually transport among the mountains of Afghanistan. Charlie was still sitting tall in his seat, not at all bothered by Vickers's tactful effort to explain why this gun simply would not work. By this time, the Egyptians had put the 600-pound base of the gun on wheels, and several mules had been harnessed to haul the dead weight up the long, steep incline. "Commence the exercise," shouted the general, whereupon a squad of soldiers pulled the blocks out from behind the ZSU's wheels and began urging the mules forward. Gust is charitable in his memory of this moment. "Egyptians win my heart because no matter how bad they fuck up, they always smile. Those fucking mules started going backward. They were in danger of going ass overhead backward, whereupon 20 Egyptians appeared from nowhere trying to hold the mules and push them back. They almost lost all the Egyptians as well." Vickers watched with astonishment as the soldiers desperately jammed rocks behind the wheels to keep the gun cart from racing backward down the landfill. Once it was stabilized, they would bravely begin again, each time with even more desperate efforts to stop the inevitable movement in the wrong direction. "If there had been a way to will it up the mountain, they would have," recalled Avrakatos. Finally, after repeated Egyptian tries and failures, Wilson himself ordered an end to the exercise. In an effort to spare the Egyptians further embarrassment, Gust said with enthusiasm, "This chicken is great. Thanks for the demonstration." Avrakatos then turned to Wilson and said, "Charlie, I can't buy it." Without missing a beat, Wilson responded, "You're right." In Gust's mind, Charlie had just passed the first ethics test. He wasn't trying to pressure the agency into buying a weapon that wouldn't work for the Afghans. There would soon be a second test for Charlie. The entourage was then ferried back across the desert to eyeball Mohammed's next offering, a warehouse filled with 800 Soviet SA-7s left over from the Yom Kippur War. These were the same type of shoulder-fired anti-aircraft weapons the agency had gotten so excited about when they were able to buy a small supply of them from the Polish general, who'd wanted a tombstone in honor of his grandfather erected in Quebec. But the station had tipped off Gust that the Egyptians tended not to maintain their old weapons well. Afrakatos, still worried that Wilson might try to put the fix in, had said, "Charlie, if the SAMs are operational, I'll buy them. But if they're not, I don't want to hear another fucking word about them." Abu Razala had assured Charlie that every SAM was in mint condition, but when they walked into the warehouse, all three of Gust's experts rolled their eyes. SA-7s, like all sophisticated electronic weapons, are supposed to be stored in temperature-controlled sanitary conditions. This desert warehouse was filled with dust, and the SA-7s were actually sitting on dirt floors. Art Alper whispered to Gust, "They aren't worth the metal put into them." The wires were burned out, and the connections were no good. Gust explained to Wilson that Vickers and Alper, the two men he trusted, said the SAMs were useless, but another expert from the station had suggested that Gust take samples back to headquarters for testing. "What did Wilson want to do?" Gust asked. "Forget the SAMs," Charlie said. "We can't give something to the Afghans that won't work." Before leaving for Egypt, the CIA's deputy director, John McMahon, had called Avrakatos into his office and issued a warning. "I want you to know that you are dealing with dynamite with Wilson. If he ever does anything that looks to you as if he is using the agency to personally profit, you let me know immediately." Wilson had now passed Avrakatos's final ethics test. "It proved to me that he wasn't out for the commissions," Gust says. "It made me 100% certain he was not Mr. 5%, and having watched him now for all these years, I can honestly say, in my opinion, there is no question that Charlie never made a dime on any of this. His motive was just to get even with the Russians. If his friends made money, he didn't give a shit, just so long as the weapons killed Russians." After the disastrous day in the desert, Gust was not very hopeful about doing much business with Mohammed. Charlie, in his typically charming manner, called the field marshal to tell him the bad news. "Mohammed, I'm afraid some of your mules fainted this morning," he said, adding that the defense minister would be furious to discover that his officers had not properly stored the SA-7s, and that the CIA couldn't consider buying them either. "Someone is going to die," Abu Razala told Charlie, who says, "I'm sure a few heads rolled that day." Although a bit embarrassed, Mohammed did not seem overly concerned. He quickly assured Wilson that he had many other weapons to offer, and that the following day he would even arrange for a visit to Egypt's most sensitive new weapons development center. That night, he insisted, the entire delegation must join him for dinner and an evening at the leading belly-dancing kasbah of Cairo, where Fifi Abdul was performing. The scene in the kasbah was right out of Casablanca, swarthy Egyptians drinking and watching the middle-aged belly-dancers. Mohammed at the best table, surrounded by equal numbers of Egyptian generals and agency operatives, and Charlie and Gust as the guests of honor. As always, flanking the table were Mohammed's bodyguards, understandable in a country where religious zealots had recently gunned down the president. As head of the Purchasing Commission, Gust was seated next to the defense minister. The agency's analytic division had prepared him for this encounter by providing a psychological profile of Razala, which Avrakatos had studied on the way over. It reported that Mohammed smoked, drank, had a roving eye, and, most fascinating of all to Gust, loved ethnic jokes. Wanting to build a bridge to this powerful potential ally, Avrakatos decided to ingratiate himself by telling Mohammed a politically incorrect joke that made fun of a certain Greek stereotype. "Did you hear the one about the little Greek boy?" he asked. "He went with the Greek girl for 3 months until he finally got into her little brother." "It's not that funny when you get down to it," acknowledges Avrakatos. "But Mohammed fucking loved it. He said, 'You're Greek, aren't you?'